You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Stephen Glassman. He's an artist calling me from L.A. Stephen, thanks so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure, Brainerd.
Stephen, let's talk about what you're working on now so listeners get oriented to what's happening in your studio in downtown L.A. What is it that you're working on or thinking about at the moment?
My work, what I really focus on is the intuitive gesture on a civic scale to make singular impacts on a civic scale that is just nothing but human. So the social scale interests me, but as a practice to that, to keep it as sort of just a essential gesture, I'm basically a painter at heart. So in front of me right now is some 5 foot by 8 foot-ish sheets of handmade Japanese paper, and I'm just applying paints to them, luminescent paints and paint sticks, working out gestures that will that either have or will again emerge in large-scale sculptural forms somewhere down the road. That's what I'm doing right now.
So let's talk about how that would emerge, because what we're talking about in terms of urban gestures, of course, is large-scale public artwork that is, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but that is sculptural in nature often, but has a kind of painterly base to it in the sense of sometimes, as you say, gestures looking like brush marks or a certain kind of mark making that is nevertheless monumental. It's sculptural and it's the size of the side of a building or some other aspect of in the urban landscape. Is that correct? Am I beginning to paraphrase that correctly?
That's correct. Yeah, I'd say that's. See, that's very correct.
So let's talk about how.
I think that maybe what I think you're responding to is that there's kind of an urgency to the work, to the act of doing that, kind of like, the 70s graffiti artists that were bombing the trains, that kind of real vibrant, urgency to make a mark on the wall that seems to be a universal human instinct, going right down to the cave paintings.
Right.
So I think that's what you're responding to when you talk about just the mark.
Yeah, I'm talking about that, and also that it doesn't look I'm responding, I think, also to your idea of the gesture that in some of the images that I've seen, in particular the time-lapse video on your website of building a whole piece, which is just kind of wonderful to watch. There's parts of that look almost like it's a painting, right? That looks
exactly.
Like it's a
that
like it's done by a brush.
Piece, yeah, that particular piece is remarkably equal parts painting and sculpture. The color work on that is.
Right, it's very really painterly
precise.
In a sense.
Yeah, very precise and very worked out. That piece was somewhat unique in my works in that the layer of finishing and color, the element of color, on that scale is rare in architecture. Period. Because of issues of permanence and corrosions. But that's the thing is to that's the target. Is to keep that spontaneous, intuitive gesture singular and powerful enough so that it can work through all those processes of, digital powder coating and, digital bending and shipping and install and, all that stuff, all those layers of atmosphere you have to pass through upon delivery, upon impact. to keep that primal gesture, because so much work gets compromised, dumbed down, the corners get rounded off, etc., and work on that scale. So to keep it lively and urgent, and through all the techniques so that it can last 100 years, you know.
That's right.
That's the intention.
So let's talk a little bit about how this all began for you. This because primarily you are working in the public, right? I mean, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but I know you make work for galleries as well. Work can be hung in a gallery, but it seems that the large part of your practice is work that ends up in the public landscape, public commissions or private commissions that are in public for one reason or another. Is that the case?
Yeah. I mean, I consider them private works and live in public.
In terms of public art, it's public art as opposed to, you know, large-scale public art as opposed to, smaller works that can be bought in a gallery and carried home or shipped or something. We're talking about a certain scale and a certain constant interaction with architecture.
Yeah.
Aren't we or no?
Yeah. I think that for me, concepts are built at every stage and are somewhat complete at every stage. So, and I think as an artist, so when you do sculpture, starting in painting, you have figure and ground. That's your context, right? The object of the painting. But you've got figure and ground. That's your constraint. And when you've got when you move that into sculpture, you've got content and context. And that relationship is particularly powerful when you're working in the public realm versus the white box of a gallery or a museum. I mean, the white box of a gallery museum gives you beautiful control and the value, you know, the idea, which is kind of the most fragile part of the artwork, can live in a museum because it's protected. It's whereas to work in a context of the public and the unprotected work, and to, you know, to live in that environment and on that scale is a little more brutal and durable interaction. But it's powerful because it affects people experience it outside of museums and white boxes because they don't come armed with judgments about it. You know, preconceived judgments about what they're walking into. They just encounter it in real life. So, I'm sorry. I guess I'm drifting off a little bit, but that's really what draws me to the outdoor. You know, the large scale outdoor work, and how figure ground, becomes content and context and active in real life when you move it into the public space.
Yeah, no, that is clear, and I don't think it drifted. That was a kind of important distinction to make. So tell me how this first happened, because it also seemed to talk about more of the aspects of it in terms of a practice. You're working in your studio and building these things like any artistic practice, but it seems that you're functioning and interacting with the art world in a slightly different way, something more akin to the independent contractor, perhaps, because you're working with architects and buildings. Maybe you could talk about how the first one happened, but I'm kind of curious about how you continue to produce things for different public spaces, and how does that come about? Is it always through open calls or applications? Is that constantly the process for you, or is there another process that brings you to these projects that you're always working on?
You know, I think since 2008, you know, since the recession, the crash of 2008, I Previous to that, it was solely competitions, but I would say that in the beginnings of my art inquiry, I did agitprop theater. And it was very much about the, for me, the nomadic form and the roadshow and the carnival vernacular and taking a conceptual intent and putting it into a popular vernacular. So I would do, you know, political protests and rock concerts, and I would do, you know, county museums and, you know, art festivals and gallery shows. And it was all about kind of crossing those lines. So that aspect was basic to my character, my instincts as a human being, as a young artist. So that sort of lent itself naturally to that kind of training in scale and collaboration and concept. Became, you know, and production became a an interesting package of skills. I was also very privileged to have become great friends, and at the time was a rogue project director for Jonathan Borofsky at the height of his mid-career retrospective at the Whitney and stuff like that. So we he was inspired by my Psycho Circus special effects type of work in the late 80s or the early 80s. And I had the privilege of working with someone who really came from pure concept into extreme production early on. So that also shaped my abilities in my set of brushes, you know.
Right, right. And so what happened after the, I mean, you say initially, and that is, we could talk about a number of aspects here, but you said initially it was open call before the economic crash of 2008. How did your practice get out into the world post-2008? What was the new method for acquiring these kind of projects?
Well, I think that I was looking at my work, and you know, even though I was doing these, you know, I was doing the work. You know, my inquiry was scale and social impact, and I was doing the work any way I could, and I was doing it primarily through these calls, but you always are generating, you know, by any means necessary to create your work on a certain scale. I took to using bamboo and became actually internationally recognized as a somewhat of a free-form structural bamboo expert. And I had I used bamboo because I could move into derelict urban sites in the wake of, well, I used bamboo primarily because of its lightweightness and, you know, its lightweight and its strength. And it allowed me to work intuitively, really, on an architectural and gestural scale. You know, it was almost gravity-defying, and its line matched my line. So I was able to sketch intuitively on an architectural scale, and I could do this in public. I came in the wake of several urban calamities in Los Angeles in the 90s, where the Cultural Affairs Department gave small grants to young artists to get out into the devastated urban sites and create a sense of resiliency and community and rebound. And I went out and did these massive kind of bamboo scaffold nests, weavings.
And what year was that when you started to do that?
That was like late 90s, I guess.
Okay.
And then that worked kind of remarkably and unintentionally caught the global eye. And the bamboo career really snowballed from there, doing things with Moscow Circus and Philippe Petit in the Cathedral St. John of the Divine, and primarily going to Bali, Indonesia, and working with a structural engineer and doing a structural bamboo bridge there in Indonesia. And that was really the breakthrough into structure. When I did that bridge, that's when I started to get approached by professional architects and engineers to do public artwork.
And so what year was that? That was after that bridge
that
was built?
That was basically from the late 90s to 2006, 7, you know, and that carried me through to like 2010. But then, so what happened was, I was already feeling that I had just moved into a bigger box, and I was banging up against a lot of the limitations, you know, you would expect and to encounter in that field, and you know, bureaucratic control and things like that. And I wanted to be more free of that. So
right.
I looked at, once again, the context and content relationship there. And I was trying to get my work bigger, powerful, more stronger, and break through this box that I felt I was in. And I realized that you could shift the context of the work. And with that, a huge shift in scale and impact happens. So specifically, I created this project, Urban Air, which was the planting bamboo forests on intelligent bamboo forests on billboards. And that project sort of took off. It got crowdfunded, and a great sort of enterprise was built around that. And that's about the most major project that I'm directly working on right now. So that's sort of a self-produced large-scale project.
And there'll be links so people can learn more about this, but can you tell us a little bit about what an intelligent bamboo forest means growing on a billboard?
So the project is now called Open Air. It moved through. We took on a collaborator. But Open Air, Open Air repurposes billboards as a, which is essentially a an anarchic blight of consumer rubbish, and transforms that into serviceable, transforms that to a serviceable infrastructure. We take off the advertising, keep the robust structure that it is, and put planters of bamboo forests up there with a water generating system that actually generates water, drinking water, you know, enough water for the plants and enough water to share with people. So it's at once this, and it's networked to other, it's networked to the net for any number, to work somewhat as a portal, as sort of like an information portal to a green and sustainable network, community, global community.
Right. It's a fascinating and wonderful idea that listeners can learn about more through the links on this interview. When you find these sites that aren't being used, I mean, how do you, if the word is correct, kind of commandeer an abandoned billboard situation? They're essentially pieces of real estate, really, aren't they?
Right, they're private property. So there have been many routes made available to us. It takes a village, you know. All these things are collaborative with partners, contributors and partners, and one of the contributors and partners was Summit Media, who offered any number of their billboards to do the project with, because they're a privately owned company and their owner is an environment, you know, a supporter of environment, of a green future and community support, you know, giving back. So that's the way we did that one. And now it's interesting because the billboard industry is really under attack here in Los Angeles. So there's some interesting creative bargaining space to be made there in that public-private grind between the billboard companies and the city right now.
And for people who are listening that may want to become more involved in this project, is there a way that the public can continue to be involved in this?
We have a website. The project was on a back burner for, you know, about 2 years while I was 100% in production on the Flows to Ways project in Manhattan. But we are up and running again with partner David Hertz and the Studio of Environmental Architecture. For now, our old website still is there and functioning and being looked at and touched again, and that is www.urbanair.is. That's .is. Urbanair.is. That will, you know, that's a good place to land for now and be able to catch in on the new transformation of it coming this year. So
it's really exciting. I'm glad we, of course, talked about that as well as some of the other aspects of what you're doing. So just to step back a little bit, that project continues, is obviously kind of large scale and constantly growing. And at the same time, you also continue to do other projects with architects and buildings, or not as much anymore?
Yes, you know, those things take a little while. You know, there's a lot of business involved with that stuff. But yes, there's one project that's just beginning here now. Here in town, here in LA, a local project, which is nice. And then there's two or three competitions that we've been in already. So, you know, I'm sort of counting more on the self-produced work these days.
The billboards and the
billboards
and the bamboo.
Yeah, well, the bamboo, but also just, you know, large scale. You know, you keep doing your work and you keep building community. You know, in a cyclical way, you can say it's who you know, but or call it a network or something like that. But human beings they live in community. I mean, this is something I think, and part of my practice is that human beings are community entities. You know, they live in community. They're not moose. Right, and I think that for me, Nicholas Aursleff, you know who I mean, at the New York Times. He often wrote about, he was an architecture critic at New York Times, somewhat iconic. And he used to speak about something called visual anarchy. He was an architecture critic. So he would talk about, you know, the work of Frank Gehry and shaking up the skyline gesture like that. So I think that even artists have a constructive relationship, even as anarchists or, you know, lone wolves within the community context. So you keep building community, and you meet with, you know, the private world at best is that you cross paths and meet other doers. And as an artist, you also, I think, you know, on a kind of shamanistic level, the social function, primitive social function of an artist is to make real what everybody is dreaming of or something and doesn't know, right? To make real the unknown, the collective unknown. So I think that there's a, you know, doing this work feels to me personally powerful and human, and it's exciting. It's very satisfying working on that scale.
It sounds like it. I think that is very satisfying to hear about, you know, in terms of how an artist can work with the public and also have a kind of social component to that. That, as you're saying, is so intertwined in the work, but also how artists function in general. It's been great talking about this. Before we go, I wanted to ask you what you're reading at the moment. It could be off topic or anything at all, but it's always what I ask.
I've been carrying around a book by Jean Genet entitled The Studio of Giacometti. And it's Genet hanging out with Giacometti in Giacometti's studio for 2 years and writing about him and Paris. And it's fascinating, kind of nonlinear.
Stephen, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking to you about your work, and look forward to hearing more about it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.